Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Be Unique Unscripted, because an authentic life is unscripted. Presented by Bronner House Museum, Elisa Kaler, the spiritual therapist, and Little Green Oasis. Unscripted brings you amazing guests and open mic nights every Thursday night at 9 o'clock Eastern Time. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an opportunity to learn more. Visit our calendar on beunique.org to see who we have scheduled to appear next. That's beunique.org.
Thought for a minute she was never going to stop playing that dong. Hi, everybody. This is Mary Brotherton. I'm your host here on Unscripted, and I'm here with my co-host, Jean Albertson. Jean, how are you doing on this fine Thursday night?
Howdy. I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Oh, it's good. It's been a day or two since we talked. Anybody who, you know, even though we have a daily show, we don't always talk to each other every day. But, right before the show about that little light that you were talking about. Everybody has a little light inside. And I know that I have to give you a little very shameful plug, I guess. In the most current issue of Be Unique magazine, you wrote about that little light inside of you shining.
Forgot about that. Yeah, definitely.
But tonight, we are here to talk with Susan Knox Kupta. She is the author of Ballasted Wings, Why That Day? And I think I'm just going to stop right there and say welcome to the show, Susan. We're so happy to have you here.
Well, thank you. It's a privilege to be here.
I really enjoyed your book. We reviewed it in the latest issue, the same one that Jean's article is in, the latest issue of Be Unique. I think. And you know what? I can't remember. It was in the December issue or the March issue. They blend because I'm already working toward the June issue now.
Oh, no.
I've got some stories for the September issue as well. So I'm kind of – people have multiple personalities. I have multiple issualities. Susan, why did you write your book, Ballasted Wings, Why That Day?
Because I had to find out why that day. And the way I could do that was through writing.
And that day, I'm sure, is the day your daughter died, right?
That's right. Why that day?
Did you find the answer to your question?
I did. It's at the end of the book.
But everybody doesn't have the book tonight.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
The reason is I was asked that question. I give a talk to police officers in crisis intervention training, and I told my daughter's story, and an officer raised his hand and said, "Why that day?" And it was such a concise, powerful question. And it blew me away, and I really was not able to answer it. And so I went home and started writing, trying to figure out why that day.
Wow. Now, the reason that you talk with them has to do with how your daughter died, correct?
Alexis was a senior. She was a senior in Barnard College. And the reason I talk to the police officers about it is they are interested in learning more about persons with mental health difficulties. So when they go to a call on people with mental health problems, they can learn what you hear about in the news a lot today, how to de-escalate situations and how to handle people that they know are having a mental health crisis, how to help them, not by being aggressive, but by being compassionate.
Exactly.
So that's why I was talking to him that day, because my daughter was really it was about my former husband, and it eventually led into my talking about my daughter, because my former husband had bipolar, and my daughter was diagnosed with bipolar as well. So it kind of led into that.
Well, that's not a fun situation to have. I know several people in my life that have bipolar, and it's very difficult to gauge, you know, because I know that medication helps. And we were talking before the show also about post-traumatic stress syndrome.
PTSD, and, yeah.
Yes. And, it, you know, if you've got medication, it does help you. But medication does other things as well. And I suppose that's probably what happened with Alexis. It was the medication and the lack of support that she needed probably just didn't balance.
Yes. She didn't find her balance in the medication. My experience was now several years back, and there have been, you know, great strides, I think. At the time, the medication would just totally zone people. Mm-hmm. I mean, at first, would zone them out. And these are often people that are highly creative and highly successful and type A's and do all kinds of things, stay up late, work around the clock. They're used to blowing and going. And then they would take this medicine that would just totally turn them in a zombie at first. And that was very, very, very difficult. And it was difficult as a family member to watch their personality just get overridden by the medication. But like I said, I think my knowledge and experience is somewhat outdated, and I hope it is. I see commercials for, bipolar medication. I believe they've made a lot of progress, but there's probably room for more progress still. It's a very difficult to medicate the brain without over-medicating, you know. But it's a tricky balance between medication and support and staying active and keeping everything together. It's difficult that first year or two.
Well, I know that my grandson is dealing with getting adjusted to his medication. And my son says mm-hmm. he sleeps a lot because of this. And
mm-hmm.
he's never been one to sleep, you know. And he's always been a go, go, go kind of kid.
Yeah. It's that go, go, go. And then it knocks you down, down, down. But
yes.
They need to hang in there, and they need transitional care. Because it takes a while to go from diagnosis to living, which you can do, to go back into living a productive, satisfactory life that you look forward to living every day. But right at first, they need a lot of help making that transition, because it takes a while to get that medication just right. But
everybody reacts differently to the medication, and what one person's ideal dosage may not be everybody's ideal dosage.
That's absolutely right. That's why it takes so long.
So when Alexis was first admitted to the psych unit and diagnosed with bipolar, that wasn't the end of her story, was it?
No, it was the beginning of her bipolar story, really.
Uh-huh.
You know, she had had quite a successful life up to that point, and had gotten admitted into an exclusive or highly competitive, I think you'd say, school, which was Barnard College in New York, and was doing real well there. And it was her senior year, which is often a time of stress. And I think watching my family that there's a real connection between stress and triggering. If you have an underlying genetic propensity to bipolar, stress can certainly add to triggering that. And I think she got stressed her senior year with all the projects due. And you know how seniors, you don't have your whole life planned. You don't have a job. I don't know. It's just a very stressful time. And that's when it hit her. and her roommate took her to the hospital, and there's where she was diagnosed with bipolar. And she was discharged and did not go into transitional care and did not have any. She just, and at the time, the policy was people with mental health disorders she withdrew from Barnard. Now they'll put you on a temporary leave of absence, but at that time she had to she probably did it voluntarily, but withdrew from college, and that isolation is a trigger for a lot of depression, as we're all finding out in COVID.
Exactly. We mentioned that before the show too. Everybody is, and I've understood and I'm not a big news follower, but I follow enough to know that the incidences of mental health issues has risen with isolation. And even though we have options like people meet through Zoom or they have their socially distanced lawn parties or whatever, there's still a lot of disconnect because people are accustomed to shaking hands or hugging, and you're not doing that anymore. So it's very difficult for a lot of people, especially the more sociable people. And I have a feeling that Alexis was a very sociable young woman.
Yes, she was. Very crushing to her to get isolated from not just from the academics, from her friends, her classmates, and her mentors, you know, the whole community. She came to live with me back I live in Oklahoma, but she wasn't satisfied with that, and so she moved to North Carolina with a cousin. But that's a beautiful place, but it's also a rural place. And she was missing New York City and all the action of her college. She spiraled. And then she quit her medicine, which is a very dangerous thing to do, to just quit your – I've learned a lot since then. But she quit cold turkey, especially her antipsychotics, which are which really helped to prevent suicidal thoughts. And she was given a antipsychotic. And she said, "Mom, I'm not psychotic. I'm not taking this." She just cold turkey. She cold turkeyed her medicines. And that really increases your suicide risk. Which means your depressions can skyrocket if you just throw those pills out, which unfortunately happens with people on these medicines. They get tired of them and they make you gain weight and, like you were saying, sleep and feel sluggish. And these are, like we were saying, a lot of times very active people. But it's very dangerous to do this on your own and just stop your medicines. And she did that. And so she became suicidal, and her cousin took her to a hospital for admission number two. So that was her second admission to a psychiatric hospital. We were using the hospitals. She was taken to a hospital twice now. And I didn't realize that's not really your only option. There are a lot of places that are set up more like a community place, you know, community health centers, and yet you can go to there are other choices in the ER, but she was to the point of, it was an emergency when her cousin took her, because she had told her she was suicidal. So anyway, she got in a second hospitalization then at age 22. She now had two inpatient hospitalizations. So it was things were happening fast and not going in the right direction.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times transitional care. And
yes.
She had no – can you explain to our audience what you mean by that?
Just the word itself. You know, when you enter – when your life is going to change – it happens in other transition. When a man or a woman retires from work, that's a big transition. When you move, when your spouse dies, you know, just different big significant things, change careers. Those are all transitions. Then when you get diagnosed with a serious physical condition, say you get an organ removed or something, have to learn a new way to live, or get diagnosed with a serious mental health condition. You have to transition and learn how to adapt and carry on with a whole new sense of normality, which again brings us back to COVID. We're all kind of transitioning to a new way of living. And you just need to kind of learn, what are the ground rules now? What can I expect? What, you know, let me get some reasonable expectations. What's the future going to look like? You need some help kind of visualizing these things. So I think that's why we're all kind of needing some more mental health care now than we did before all this, because we're all transitioning in a way. But when you have a serious mental health diagnosis, you definitely should have someone there to help you get your medicine straight and give you hope and vision. There's a program that I'm very interested in now. It was developed in 2014 called College Reentry. And currently it's just offered in New York City and Boston University. But it's specifically set up to help college students that are on mental health leave transition back into college, because 85% of the college kids that get put on mental health leave do not return back to college. And if you go to this one, and it's huge. So if you go to this one, I didn't never know all this either earlier, but if you go to this college reentry program, which is a semester long program, they help transition you, get you ready to go back to college. And then 85% of the students do return. They totally flip-flop the statistic. But it's real difficult if you're you need to be a full-time student usually to live in the housing, and that means you need to take 12 hours, you know, of courses, 3-4 classes, and that's a heavy course load for somebody that's on this medicine that kind of slows your brain down a little bit.
Sure,
so it's real
sure.
hard for them to get back full, you know, to just go back and return to being a full-time student. So this called College Reentry Program is a good bridge, gives them a pathway back to college. So things like that are starting to be developed, and I hope they take off and continue to be developed, because I think a program like that might have helped. I'm sure it would have helped Alexis if she knew she had a way to go back to Barnard. Yeah.
I need to take a real quick break, but then I want to come back and talk about bipolar links for a few minutes.
Oh, okay. That'd be fun. Thank you.
Okay, you're welcome.
Let me ask you a question. Do you prefer coffee or tea? This is a question we ask on our fun and informative millennial talk show called Coffee or Tea, No Phones Allowed. And why do I know? Because I'm Anna. I'm one of the co-hosts. It's a great time. It's a professionally edited weekly series that's free to watch on Be Unique's YouTube channel. That's BUNEKE. Be sure to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode, and leave us a comment with your topic or guest recommendation. We love hearing from you.
And we are back. I'm Mary, and Gene is in the corner over there behaving himself, I'm pretty sure. Say hey,
yeah.
Gene.
Hey. How you guys?
We're here with Susan Knox Copta, and we're talking about her book, Ballasted Wings, Why That Day, her daughter Alexis, and we're talking about bipolar as well as other things. And I know that Susan has a website called bipolarlinks.com. Now, I know that you're using that to get more resources for people who have bipolar. Am I correct?
Oh, that's correct, and I also do it for my family members. Things are so different now. Even though it wasn't, I mean, it was 2006, but when a family member gets diagnosed with a serious mental illness, sometimes your whole world is turned upside down for a while, and you're so overwhelmed. And even Alexis and I did not have really any resources. We didn't really know where to turn. And And today is almost the opposite problem. If you just Google bipolar, you'll find so much and you'll be overwhelmed. And so I tried to make a website that kind of categorized the different areas in which you might need help. You know, do you need to understand what is bipolar? So I have a page for that. Do you need to know where can I get treatment? And so I have a page for treatment. What if you already have bipolar and you're already settling back down? Do you want to know who can I connect with that, you know, that also has these problems? So I have a connection page to a lot of organizations. I call it Life, so you can get back involved in life. And anyway, there's a page. You kind of can curate your own path. But it has links to, I mean, the bipolar links itself is a little overwhelming because there's so many links. But what you have to do is find the area in which you need links. Or if you're a family member, I have links to places where family members can find support. So there's links to, you know, maybe maybe I need to rethink my college now. What do I need to get a degree in that would work well with bipolar? And so there's some conversations that you can find about what can a bipolar person link into a nice career. There's just a lot of different areas, but I try to break it down so you don't have to look through the whole website. You just go find what areas will be helpful for you at your stage that you're in.
Well, I know when I first visited, I was just mesmerized by the colors of those, the artwork that you've got. Those are really cool.
They are cool. That's a lot of from GoDaddy. There's some cool artwork that they have.
Yeah, and I think it's really neat because it really kind of looks like the inside of my brain some days, which is scary.
I did that because I wanted other people and other families to not feel so overwhelmed, helpless, or alone, because you are not alone. There are many, many resources, many, many facilities, many, many online organizations. And there's back when we get in person, there's local organizations. There's so many resources. And NAMI is a very good one. There's just a lot of them. And
NAMI stands for the National Association of Mental something.
Use the word illness, which is kind of getting a little outdated. People prefer to say mental wellness and mental, you know, different things. But it is an illness, just like a physical illness. You know, there hardly should be a distinction anymore between mental and physical because they're so connected.
There shouldn't be, and I will tell you that if you have a physical illness, it's manifested, you can see a rash or whatever. It's like it's kind of like the autoimmune diseases that people have. You can't see lupus. You don't know what is going on. But then there are things like eczema or psoriasis or hives that manifest physically. Yet,
yes,
they can all impact your mental stability, your mental well-being.
And absolutely, that's right.
And if someone has a mental health issue, they don't always know how to express it because it's just the way they are. They don't know that it's not. You don't know if it's broken if it's always been broken.
Right, yeah, and a lot of times people have mania. I think probably my former husband and my daughter both had a lot of mania where they accomplished a lot. Like I say, they could stay up late and be creative, and they don't really complain about that, even though maybe they might go without sleep for a couple of nights. They don't really complain about mania because it can be so productive. But then the longer you wait to get it diagnosed, it's not good. It's better to catch it early, but you usually wait until you have a big crash, the depression side.
Right, because that's the part that
doesn't
hurts.
Always kick in. Yeah, that's the part that hurts. And so you get treatment for that. But so a lot of times it goes undiagnosed for quite a long time because people do not seek help for the mania. as much as I do for the depression.
And
you don't
think
always have
probably,
the two together.
Right. And I know that a lot of times people who deal with the mania, they may go for months and they're very happy and productive and they're energetic. And then when the depression hits, it hits so hard that they can't even pick up the phone.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
much less go to a doctor. So you have to kind of catch them in between if you can, and get the treatment that you need, because it's the medication downplays the mania and makes it hard. You know, if someone, let's just say that you're a composer or some kind of artist or dancer, and you're doing your art basically while you're in a manic state, you're on fire. And I've seen a lot of documentaries about some famous artists throughout history who've had this. And then when they crash so hard that they just go into a reclusive state. But that's probably when they don't need to be isolated.
Yeah, that's exactly. Well, you're right. Isolation is a very high risk factor for suicide. And you really want to avoid isolation, which is a mistake I made with Alexis. I thought it sounded like a good idea for her to go to somewhere quiet and kind of get rest and restore, be around loved ones. But she really needed to be in a community where she would be getting help. That's something like that transitional care. She should have been at a mental health facility, inpatient mental health facility for like 1 to 3 months, probably. When you go to the ER, that's something that maybe we were going to talk about. When you go to an emergency room, they're like putting a Band-Aid on you and send you out. And you an emergency room, that's why I would caution people to do that. They've actually found out now that when you're released from emergency room after a suicidal threat, you're going to be at a high risk of suicide when you are released. And that just goes contrary to all our thinking. We think, well, we take people to the hospital to get better. And how can they be released at the high risk of suicide? I mean, that's why we took them in, you know. And they do stop them from being suicidal at that moment, but they need really to be in a it's just you need to really watch them when they get out of the hospital, because that's a high risk time. And Alexis, after her third hospitalization, died within a few days after release from there. So she fell into that statistic that I wasn't even aware of. You know, I was of the mindset, well, you go to the hospital and when you're released, I guess that means you're okay, you know?
Yeah, when the experts tell you go home, you assume they're telling you this for your own good. Now, and that brings up a point that I wanted to ask you. You said that Alexis drove before she was stable. How do you determine when someone's ready to be driving again?
Well, I just think it was too quick. I think probably there should be a pretty general rule of thumb, especially in light of the new evidence that there's a high risk of suicide after you're released, after being hospitalized particularly if you have been suicidal, and that's why you went to the hospital, when you get out. And the thing is, people think about, well, we'll make sure there's, if you're thinking properly as a family member, you think, well, we'll remove the obvious suicidal tools that someone may use. And usually you think of guns and things like that. But you don't think of a car. And that's what another thing I wished I had had awareness of, that in the wrong hands.
We don't think of cars as tools.
No, and she needed to get to her therapy appointment. She was going to her therapy appointment, and she was in North Carolina, not with me. And so she drove a car, and she said she was going to. Anyway, you don't think of that, but people need to be aware that that you know, they have single, actually, we don't know for sure that hers was a, I don't really think, that's kind of where my book is ambiguous. It was exact suicide, but she was reckless, which is a sign of mania. And you can also have mixed episodes,
Susan,
where you, is the, yes?
I'm having difficulty hearing you. Jean, can you hear her?
Yeah.
I can.
Yeah.
I hear her, but I don't understand
okay.
the words.
Can you hear me, Mary?
No, you sound like you're underwater too.
Oh no.
Uh-oh. Well, maybe Jean and I'll have to talk.
Well, sure,
yeah.
sure. You can continue our story. There's a good chance that the listeners can all hear.
You're hearing her? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, then I won't worry about
yeah.
it. Because whatever it was has changed. I can hear everything fine now.
Awesome.
Huh.
That was so
well,
weird.
I'm glad we're back on track.
Well, yes.
I was going to say that there's a thing called a mixed episode, which is very risky. And I kind of think that may have been what Alexis was having, because she was kind of getting excited about maybe had decided to accept the fact that she had bipolar and get better. And so if you combine, if you combine depression with a little energy of mania, they say that's a dangerous time, but also mania can lead to recklessness. So when she drove home from her therapy appointment in these mountain roads, she got going too fast. And her right wheel went off the road, and she did that overcorrection thing where you pull hard to the left, you know, and then once the tire gets back on the road, then you fling across the lane, and she hit an oncoming truck head on. But she wouldn't have known it was coming because it was around a blind curve. So the people that investigated the accident tell me there's no way she could have done all that on purpose, but as a mother, you just don't know how to put a label on it. But one way or the other, she was being reckless with her life. And but anyway, she died coming home. I think I want people to be aware that cars can be a dangerous thing to let someone have that has not yet found stability. I mean, you would know that you know, it sounds like maybe like your grandson maybe isn't quite stable yet. He's still dealing with getting used to his medicine.
Uh-huh.
So he's not stable yet. So, and Alexis certainly wasn't. She was just out of the hospital. I mean, it can take months to get stable, maybe even years. So, but anyway, you should be aware that there's a risk of suicide after release from the hospital and that cars can be very dangerous. Those are two things I wished I had known, and that isolation is dangerous. It's not good to go off somewhere isolated and try to recover. You need help. You need therapy and guidance, you know.
Exactly. You need to be able to have your circle of friends around you to help you and
yes,
people who know
right.
you.
But, you know, now there's so many organizations online that you can there's a lot. There are a lot of them are on bipolar links, but there's you don't have to actually go somewhere. You know, like we're all learning with COVID that there's lot of connections you can make on your computer and feel connected and feel supported. And even with Zooms and private chat rooms, it can be personal. You know, you can even do therapy, you know, personally without being in person.
That's true.
Well,
that's true. In fact,
well,
my grandson uses.
We're all used to doing it now.
Yeah, he and his therapist use Zoom, and it makes a difference.
Mm-hmm.
I know. In a way, I think this has accelerated so many things to where we probably would have been, but not for another 20 years. You know, we're doing so many things. Virtually that are probably even more efficient to do that way. And so we're learning. We're all learning and learning at a rapid rate how to
yes.
stay connected.
And that's what it all boils down to, is being connected and staying with your people that are able to help you and support you.
Yeah, and it also... Boyle, they say that the first step in healing is acceptance. And she did not want to accept her diagnosis of bipolar. And that was a real detriment right there. If right out of the block, you can't deny it. You have to be able to say, yes, I have this. And you have to accept it, because once you accept it, then you can take the step of, okay, how can I manage this? Because you have to really manage bipolar. But before you can get to wanting to learn how to manage it, you have to accept that you have it. And she didn't want to have anything to do with that, because her father had not set a good example at all. It wasn't all his fault. He also didn't have good good physician help, but he did not handle his bipolar well, and so she watched him have mood swings and all kinds of problems. And she said, oh, she heard she had bipolar. She said, I don't want to be like that. And
oh,
she just was scared. Yeah, scared to death of it. And so I think I want to say to parents, if parents have bipolar, the best, and so many of them worry. They worry, worry, worry. What if my child has it? But what if your child has it? The best you can do is be a good role model for them. Be, you know, open and say, because bipolar is not really to be feared if you just accept it and manage it. So if you get a diagnosis of it, you can say, yeah, well, my mom has it and she manages hers real well. And some, you know, and you just tell your child openly that, yes, I have it. And this is what I do to manage my life and how I take care of myself. And so it, rather than worrying if your child gets it, just, you know, take care of yourself and be a good role model, and that will be a huge help to your child.
Exactly. And it's the same with any disease. You hear people who say, well, I've got this mole and it keeps changing. I'm not going to go to the doctor because I'm afraid it might be cancer. Well, if you don't go and you don't get it fixed, how are you going to be able to get it cured?
Exactly. And that's what the thing is with mania, because like I didn't, all the literature is the earlier you get in, it's really difficult to treat bipolar if you wait as late, like Alexis was way down the line, already suicidal. If you can go in when you're just having some manic times and just lighter depression, you know, I don't know, but just get it before you're suicidal. They say that there's chances of managing your life are a lot easier. And if I had picked up on the fact that even when she was in, I think even grade school, and she would tell me, I would come wake her up for school and she'd be so sleepy. And she said, Mom, I just got to sleep a couple hours ago. I've been all awake all night. And Alexis, no, you haven't. You know, I put
just
you
because
to sleep.
She's
I saw
quiet.
You fall asleep.
Yeah.
And
she may have fallen asleep,
if you,
but she may not have slept well.
Well, see, this is before we knew not about blue light. We didn't know about how. So we had a computer in her bedroom, and she'd get out of bed and start on that computer, and I think she stayed on it all night. And now we know that you can't do the blue light. But anyway, if you notice that your child or even your college student tells you, I'm staying up for two or three nights, well, that's a big red flag. You know, you need to go check. Maybe they're having some mania, and you need to get it clipped before you do, like you're talking about, zoom so high and then crash so low. You got to get it before you hit those big spikes. So if you see it coming, and you also need to, if you do have depression, you've got to make sure that you tell your doctor that you have had some mania, because if they give you, I'm no doctor, I'm not giving doctor advice, but this is what I've read that. So, and it happened to my former husband, so I know too, but they give you antidepressants because they're not aware of the mania, and maybe that's because you didn't tell them, and because we don't have a good test for it now. It mostly has to come from self-reporting. So if you're only complaining of depression and they put you on antidepressants, that's not the protocol for bipolar. You should be given like a mood stabilizer or something, and because if you think of bipolar as like the scales of justice, and so you really knock down that depression, Well, it pops up, it can pop up the mania. And that's what happened to my former husband. He was misdiagnosed with depression, or treated only for depression, because that's all he complained about. Got antidepressants,
right.
His mania took off. He started going to Las Vegas and gambling. Just stuff was so out of character, and it was his mania taking off. And I had no clue at the time. I just knew his mood swings were getting worse. Like I say, he was a bad role model, but when really it wasn't all his fault. He was given wrong medications. But so you have to be really in tune to the mania, and be sure to report that if you go to a doctor for depression and you're aware that you've had some mania times without any sleep and high productivity and scattered ideas and things like that. That's important to tell your doctor so you get on the right medicines.
Yeah, because there are so many different options out there for medication that it's really, like we said earlier, there's a fine-tuning and an adjustment period.
Well, yes, there is. And your doctor needs to be fully aware of the mania symptoms. And so be sure, you know, like you say, those don't hurt, and you kind of like those, and you don't really think of them as a medical problem, but they're part of the picture that a doctor needs to be informed of to get the right medicines.
Right. I'm going to take another little break real quick, and we'll be right back with Susan Knox Copta.
If you like the show tonight, let us know. Call 321-417-4309 or email mary@beunique.org to ask how you can sponsor the show. It's simple and doesn't have to cost much at all. Visit beunique.org for even more details. That's BUNEKE.org. Join the global world changers who already know how Be Unique helps bring together like-minded humans who are making the world a better place. Read the magazine and blog posts, watch our videos, listen to our podcast, and visit our social media from one location, and let's work together. Change tomorrow by finding solutions today. Visit BeUnique.org to learn more. That's BUNEKE.org.
We are back. I'm Mary. I'm here with Jean and Susan Knox Copta. We're talking about Susan's book, and it's a real easy, quick read called Ballasted Wings, Why That Day. It has to do with things nobody wants to talk about, but you have to talk about them. Bipolar and suicide or reckless driving that may or may not be, you know, maybe Alexis didn't want to take her life, but she certainly was reckless. So we're talking about things like that. We're also talking about Susan's website called bipolarlinks.com, a wealth of information on that page. I ran out of fuel just then. I'm sorry, folks.
Well, I thought of something. I was listening to your your ad, and Be Unique is so perfect for bipolar, because so many people, we have so many beautiful souls that are bipolar, you know, easily comes to mind, Robin Williams, but many people with bipolar, and we lost him to suicide, and it just gives me chills, and the souls, the beautiful, beautiful, unique souls that we lose to, that we don't need to lose, if they would accept they have bipolar and spend that 6 months they need to get transitioned onto the right medicine routine, then they have a ton of possibilities and so much to contribute if they can just accept, well, first get the diagnosis, be aware of your, be in tune with your body, and if you notice you're out of sync and not sleeping like ordinary people do, then, you know, check on it. Check on yourself and take care of yourself, and don't let yourself get to that super high point of mania where you crash to the super depths and get in suicidal depression. So, you know, watch yourself and be careful and be unique, but be aware that your uniqueness sometimes needs some little attention so you can stick around and be with us.
Everything requires balance. And yeah. I think for a lot of people, especially creative people, but scientific people as well. My husband is a computer programmer, and I would never say that he was bipolar, because he's not manic, but he also has, he may be prone to depression, but I think a lot of that's just absolute sleep craziness, because he gets really bent on his programming. But any people, it doesn't matter what your field is, you've got to learn to balance. And that's something that I'm struggling with myself. As the president of Be Unique, I have a lot on my plate, and I have to make sure that my plate doesn't overflow, because there's no balance
that's
when
right.
I do that.
That's
something
right.
that you,
we are getting a lot better on our wellness. There's a lot of attention
yes.
paid.
Well,
wellness.
It's
no.
because it's the stigmas are being removed,
which is wonderful. Well, one thing about
yeah.
all this wellness movement, pardon me.
Well, I was just thinking about, you're thinking about stigmas. Just think, if you have a manic personality in the workplace, that's going to be more acceptable than the depression, as far as productivity in the eyes of the business and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
So, it wouldn't be something people would raise their eyebrows at if they were, benefiting from it as a business.
In fact, they get a lot of awards. Just my husband was a very successful trial attorney. It was great. Alexis had awards all through really grade school up to college. They get awarded. They get rewarded
sure.
for everything they're accomplishing. But really, they're being a little superhuman. But we
right.
do as a society reward that.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting
thing. I've
no
been called
to get help.
I've been called the Energizer Bunny, and that made me stop and really think that probably I need to slow down.
Saying, really telling you that you're being a little bit extraordinary
probably,
there.
Probably being a little bit manic and not even knowing it. I did want to ask
you. A little bit's good. Uh-huh.
I wanted to ask you about something that you're advocating for. I know that you're very adamant that if Alexis had had the proper care, the proper transitional care, as well as more information and a stronger support, just transitional care is the biggest thing, her discharge time period. If that had been handled differently, then she might be here today. And you're
yeah.
advocating to have this omission of transitional care options and the family needs to be informed that the risk of suicide can increase with early post-discharge time. You're trying
right.
to have that trying to form my words. You know what I'm trying to say, don't you, Susan?
Well, I'm trying to raise awareness of that, number one.
Yes.
Because you can't fix it, or if you're not aware of it. And I was an attorney until Alexis's death. I stopped practicing law, but there's a thing that called informed consent. And when you leave, when there's a known risk, you're usually supposed to be told about it. And I don't know how you could be discharged from a hospital into a known risk of high suicide rate and not be told about it. It seems to me that you have a right to be informed that you're stepping into danger when you leave a hospital after a suicide attempt, and that you're not really, you need to be really warned that this is a dangerous time and you better get yourself into transitional care right away.
There's
a lot more. Yeah.
If I were, let's just scenario, what do you call it? I hypothesize here. Suppose I went to the hospital, the emergency room. I had fallen and gotten cut, and maybe I had a concussion. They stitch up the wound. They put ice on my head. And they should give me at least a sheet of paper that says, you have a concussion. These are the things to be aware of. I would imagine if I had gone and had outpatient cancer surgery, as you know, people do that all the time. They give you a sheet of paper that at least tells you, you need to take this medication. You need to come back and see your doctor. You need to do this and this and this, or you risk opening up the wound or infection or whatever. If someone has been admitted or treated at the hospital emergency room or admitted for a few days for a suicide attempt or even a suicide concern, I guess, I believe that the medical professionals have an obligation to tell them and their family this, you know, you're going home earlier than you should. You need to stay here for, I don't know, 20 days or I don't know what the time is, but more than just a couple of hours. And your risk of suicide is going to increase if you leave early. So I think it is.
That confuses me too as a lawyer that you know why, but I maybe things are better today. But I think it's just that we didn't even hardly use the word suicide. And if they put on a big piece of paper, they probably do say get a follow up care appointment within the next, you know, within the first week or few hours. But I wish they would write on there, because if you don't, your risk of suicide, or you know, I think they need to tell you why it's so important to get in there. And it really, even the first, I think the first 72 hours are very high risk, but I wish they would just give a little bit more information, and perhaps they do now, but I think that just general, I would like the word to get around that.
Now,
but that's
prior,
why. That's why.
Prior to the auto accident that took her life, had Alexis done anything to make anybody, I mean, I know she was admitted, but had she actually tried to commit suicide, or had she just talked about it?
She talked about it and she made a plan. Now the suicide prevention people say that you're not really supposed to discuss details. It's like not a good idea to give
right,
other
you give other people ideas.
Yeah, or something, but just the general idea that she became suicidal. She made a plan, and then she decided not to carry it out. But she went back to her cousin's house and told her cousin, look, I'm scared because I made this plan and I was going to carry it out but decided not to. And so she didn't attempt it, but she had it all planned. And
because I was thinking, had she gone into – you know, had she been rushed to the hospital with slit wrists, they would They would have taken a stronger approach to her aftercare release. But because there was nothing physical showing, remember we talked earlier about the physical and hidden signs of bipolar syndrome and other illnesses.
Uh-huh.
You know, if she had no physical, you know, she hadn't, I'm trying not to.
Yeah, that's true.
You're right.
She did not have any physical signs that she had had these high suicide thoughts. But you're right, that didn't make a difference. Maybe that made her treated her a little differently because she didn't have that. That's possible. Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that. That's possible, but it didn't mean that her, I guess she didn't take that one next step. But it didn't diminish the fact that it still should have been
treated very seriously.
Yeah.
I will say, now you said this was in 2006.
Yeah, so that's quite a long time ago now.
Well, I can tell you that with my grandson, he's 15 now. Last year was when everything came to light. We'd been having our suspicions and thoughts and wondering about little things he'd said and done that made us think, this kid needs some help. So finally, my son got him the help that he needed. But it was It wasn't like he said, okay, son, you need help. Let's go to the doctor. It was more like the kid was crying out for help. And so he was actually admitted, self-admitted or parental admitted, I don't know what the difference is, to the psych ward for, I think, 72 hours. And within a week, he went to his dad and said, I think I need to go back to the hospital because these are the thoughts I'm having. Well, then, of course, you know, he was then put in for a week. And he liked it there, which was odd. But the first thing that my son said to the attending physician was, he cannot think that coming to the emergency room or going into the psych ward is the answer. We need to help him learn to cope with these situations. So immediately they took him, you know, found him a good therapist and put him on medication, and we'll see what happens.
That's exactly right. You're exactly right. And that's why you asked me why that day the answer was. I said the answer was because her emotional difficulties outweighed her coping skills. And that's what you're saying, that your son recognized that. And he saw his son needed to get some more tools to learn how to cope. And Alexis didn't have the tools. So you hit it right on the nail.
I have to interrupt here because we're talking about this help that we're trying to create and we've identified. I have a cousin who is bipolar, was diagnosed bipolar 40 years ago. And we live in South Dakota, and he lived in one side of the state, and the state hospital was in the other side of the state. Now, at the time, that was the only technology they had on bipolar, was in that state hospital, I'm almost positive. And he went there and got the medicine and was felt better, and he went home, and of course, he quit his medicine. You described his story there. He didn't like it, it didn't work, and of course, everything went bad, and he went back again across the state. They gave him the medicine again. He stayed there a while, and he ended up going back, and they finally didn't send him. They kept him near the hospital after they had no way of knowing. He was crawling down the interstate at 10 o'clock at night one night, 10 miles from the house in the country. He lived in the country on a farm, and they kept sending him back to this isolated spot you described. And that would be part of exactly it. And finally, he ended up going back, and they didn't send him back. He ended up in a halfway house for several years, and he's living peacefully now in the town where the hospital is, independently, semi-independently. But
that's exactly what he needed, was that halfway house. That's what my daughter needed.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And he had to go one place.
You can't
in the
just
whole
go home
to
back
it.
To this isolated thing. That's exactly what happened to your family member.
Yeah.
It doesn't
work. Mm-mm.
Well, I'm happy to hear a good ending because I think you really did the show well with that, because that's how it should be. It should be how it worked out with your family member and should not be like my daughter's. But there is hope. There is a good way to work through it. If you transition like that, you just don't zip back and be isolated and quit your medicine. That's terrible. It's a disaster.
And
you get transitional care and you stay on your meds and you accept it and you learn to figure out how to live with it.
That is the perfect note, because we have less than a minute to say goodbye. And they're going to cut us off exactly in that time frame.
Happy to end on that happy note.
I am too. And I want to remind everybody to go check out Bipolar Links. And do not be afraid to reach out to someone. And if you don't know anybody else, call the suicide hotline, because even if you're not contemplating, they can help you.
Yep.
They can steer you to someone else.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate
you're
it.
You're very
I hope
welcome.
People out there will help.
Thank you. For
I'm
so
absolutely
much.
Certain that we have. Thank you both. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening this evening. We're happy you chose to spend this time with us, and we hope you learned as much as we did.
Every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And if you'd like us to invite you or someone you know to speak right here, just go to beunique.org and contact us there.
I'm still trying to wrap my head around the fact that our newly branded podcast has so many global listeners and that our website and magazine receive thousands of visitors each month. Let's put your brand in front of all those people. Mary can share the demographics with you. Contact her through the website. That's BUNEKE.org.